What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to The Big Thing. Thank you for everybody who's been joining us. This is a fun episode today. I got Griffin Newman, Griffy Nooms, Blank Check, Masters of the Universe, and Downtown Griffy Newman from the Schmodown. We have so much to talk about, he and I. We're just going to bullshit about movies, to be completely honest with you, but I want to talk to him in general. Last time I spoke to him was on Collider Live, and we didn't really get to dive into the deepness that is Griffin Newman, and I'm going to get some more answers out of him. So that's what's going to happen on today's show. But to also let you guys know, if you didn't already know this, on October 8th, we're going to be in New York. Speaking of Griffin Newman, he's going to be there on October 9th battling Josh Horowitz. But I will be battling the New York crowd once again. I'll be in New York Comedy Club with Mark Ellis, getting back on that New York stage. Get tickets, markellis.live. If you are in the Los Angeles area on the 26th, I will also be doing some comedy there at the Flappers Comedy Club in Burbank. So please come out and check that out. Links are in the description. But we're not talking about me anymore. We're talking about Griffin Newman. We're doing the big thing. We're going to have some fun. Join us. Here we go. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is The Big Thing. It's me. It's Christian Harloff. It's you, the audience. And it's this guy, Griffin Newman. It's Griffin Newman, ladies and gentlemen. How you doing, Griff?
Good. Should I adjust? Should I be more like this? Is that the angle?
I think that's the way that, you know what? Normally the other kids do it the other way, but I like the way you're doing it.
Maybe this is the way to do it.
I think it's more attractive. I think it's more professional.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. Look at that. You can maneuver around that. I like that. Look at that shirt.
Isn't this good?
It's a really good shirt. Where did you get that?
I'll tell you, the thing I've been doing is, I think like a lot of people, looking around your garage, I have a feeling you're the same way.
Look at my garage. I mean, you're in it.
I know. I wish, I will say, just being here makes me jealous of the fact that I live in New York and don't have a garage. Just not because I don't have a driver's license. Right. I wish I had this extra space to put all my bullshit.
It took a while. I'll tell you what, it took a while for me to figure this all out on how to do this in general. And it was one of the main things of trying to, when I left Collider, it was in order to find a place, I had to find somewhere that I could turn into my own playhouse to where I could buy a Tony Soprano painting. And my wife was like, you're not putting that anywhere except here.
Right. Yeah. See, I'm in the backwards order, which is I need a place to put all my stuff so that that doesn't hinder the ability to get a wife.
Makes sense.
Yeah, so like here's the normal place you get to
this is where you're gonna cohabitate hang out. With. You're not. Don't worry about that spot.
Don't worry about that.
That's
you don't
my
have
dark
to
spot.
Look at that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to see you, man.
Good to see you too. What was I gonna say? There was something I was gonna say before I started talking about all the stuff in here, the garage. I don't know. We're gonna talk.
We're gonna talk. It's something I wanted to do for a while with you because it's so funny. Because Alex Marzonia,
yes,
he might be your biggest fan.
He's up there. He certainly put in the work. He helped me a lot in terms of getting into Schmodown. Yeah.
Well, that's the funny thing is he didn't have to.
Yeah.
Where like after we had that conversation, everything too. Right. But he's like, dude, you got to watch this guy. Like, he's not gonna just like be like a celebrity that competes. He's going to be good. And boy, are you.
Right. Well, I think the thing he knew too is I host this podcast Blank Check with David Sims, who's a film critic at The Atlantic. And that podcast came out of David and I being obsessed with a weekly movie trivia night in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
This bar, RIP, Videology, that was this great place in Williamsburg that used to be a DVD rental place. And then when that sort of cratered, they became a movie-themed bar where you could still rent movies,
which was
a pretty cool gimmick. Pretty cool, so you get drunk and go like, oh, watch this.
Right.
And then you give them the $5 and whatever. But they had a back room.
And then no one returns anything.
I mean, it was pretty consistent. I don't know.
Really?
I mean, you're asking a good question. It feels like, no, just sunk cost.
Right.
Constantly. But I think it was pretty good. I think people would sober up and go, oh, I have to watch this. And then, get it done. But they did a weekly movie trivia night that was, like, really high level. And I liked trivia a little bit.
Yeah.
I found myself accidentally at a bar trivia night last night, but I got kind of frustrated with it, with the sloppiness of it and the vagueness of the questions. And this was really laser-focused. It was this woman, Maggie Ross, who was a UCB performer in New York, is out here now. She was funny. She knew exactly what to do with it. The questions were really well-crafted. And most of the people who would go to this were in the industry or critics or at the very least like current film school students. Yeah. Everyone was like super high level. Once a week you'd see like a couple come in and being like, oh, this is like a fun first date. And after the first round they'd be like, out of here.
Right.
Done.
Right.
This is not fun. This is intense. Why would anyone know any of this?
Yeah.
But David, a friend had connected us on Twitter and said, you guys should hang out.
You and David.
Yeah, we didn't know each other. Yeah. We hung out once, and then a couple months later, we were like, you want to do that again? We go hang out. A mutual friend of ours, Pilot, texts him,
yeah,
and says, I'm at this trivia night, we're bombing, do you want to come and, like, be pinch hitter?
Yeah.
We went, yeah, why not? Second time we've ever hung out, we go to this thing. I had just gotten fired off of a network sitcom. David had just gotten out of a long relationship, and we both immediately were like, do you want to center our entire lives around this? Is this going to be the whole thing for us?
Right.
This is where we put all the energy.
This is our essence.
Right. So we did it for like a year and a half, and we're like very all consumed by it and became the top team there until the point where we were like, this is too much. We need to move on. And then we stopped hanging out, and Blank Check came out of like, we need some new weekly structure to see each other.
Yeah.
Let's just come up with an idea to do that. Someone like Marzonia, who listens to the show, knows not only does this guy say stuff on the show that sounds like he has a trivia brain, but this entire show's existence stems out of Trivia Night.
Yeah. Well, people love the show. People love Blank Check. I'm telling you, like, there's so many people, even like Kaiser, manager on the show, is like, dude, you got to listen to this guy's show. It's just, because getting to know you more, you can tell that you, not only are you a film buff, like, you've got a very fun personality. You just, you're a good conversationalist. And I think, so, like, that's always, you want to feel, no matter who you're listening to, that you can, that you feel if you put yourself in that room with that person, you could just have a conversation with them. They're not talking, like, down to you.
Yes, yes. That's, I mean, as much as we, you know, I'm sure you do the same thing, but when you have these projects that stem out of like something I like doing for fun with my friend, and then they become in any way popular, it's you have to semi-regularly sort of like step back, do a pulse check, and go like, why is this working?
Right.
This happens sort of organically. Mm-hmm. What are people reacting positively to here so I don't mess it up and blow it? What are the things I should remain focused on and retain? And as much as we figured out what works with the show, it is that David and I feel very lucky that we found each other.
Yeah.
As much as that sounds like a romantic comedy thing, but it is true where it's like, oh, I found a friend who sort of thinks about the same stuff that I do.
Yeah.
I have other friends who are movie fans, and there are other things I talk about, you know, with other people. But Dave and I have such a strong overlap in things that we find interesting, even that most movie buffs do not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of what has been successful about the show is people going, I never found that friend. And now I once a week get to be part of this conversation. And it doesn't feel highfalutin.
Yeah, it's inclusive.
It's inclusive and it's casual and it's a hangout thing. Yeah.
Yeah, you can tell. I mean, look, that's very, I relate to that very much because Mark Ellis and I, we met on the comedy scene.
Right.
Had no idea if we were going to, like, what we were, as far as making movies, starting a brand.
Right.
That was never, we never had an intent. It was very similar to what you're talking about.
Sure.
It was a matter of he and I hanging out. We got, our friend asked us to do, like, some, point at one of those flip cams on each other and review TV shows.
Right.
We're like, hey, Rick, this is fun for us to do.
Right.
And then people start watching it, like the chemistry, like it, and you're like, okay. But I agree 100% and relate to what you're saying. You step back and you go, because a lot of people say to me, why didn't you just keep the Schmoes No Show? It was working. It's got to work for you, too, and you've got to feel the right way when you're doing it. Yeah.
I mean, our thing was, when we started, it was just sort of like, we should do a podcast. The way I think a lot of people go, like, I don't know, we should do a podcast, right? And our idea was, what if we do a show that's only about The Phantom Menace? The Phantom Menace is the only thing we ever talk about, but we talk about it through a prism of, that was a failed franchise.
Right.
Because Lucas always says, no, you should watch them in this order, right?
Yeah.
Which I always thought was bunk. But I always also had the question, if you were to watch Phantom Menace in a bubble without the baggage of the Star Wars movies that are better, does that movie then improve? If you're not having to constantly, because when people criticize Phantom Menace, and the same thing now happens with the Disney movies, it's constantly, well, this is what they do wrong that the originals did right.
Right.
And it's like, is there any way to just silo this movie and view it as its own thing? Which I thought was funny, and I also thought it was funny to sort of treat it like it was Jupiter Ascending. And it was like, well, clearly they had all this attention, and they never got to do any of the other stuff.
100%.
They just never got around to it. So we thought that was funny. Pitched it to my friend who was working at a podcast network for the time.
He ran
up to his boss, and he was like, I don't know, why not? We were like, we could do this show indefinitely. And they were like, you can do 10 episodes.
Yeah.
You're going to run dry for 10 episodes. And we're like, okay, you're going to be eat crow. We do 10 episodes. We had run so dry. But it was fun. Like, the chemistry was fun. So we went, what if we discover Attack of the Clones? What if it's one by one we're unearthing this, and we're discovering these movies in the wrong order? And we did that for like a year. and got through all of the Star Wars movies, and that was 2015. That year ends with Force Awakens coming out. It felt like it was a nice sort of full circle thing. And then we went, well, what do we do now? Like, what is the show?
Right.
It wasn't huge, but we had noticed that it had extended beyond people we knew personally.
Yeah.
And those people were really in on it. So it was like, it feels like we have something, the chemistry here, what we talk about, how we talk about it, how deep we go into all of this. And the show, by the way, at that point had like no proper name. It was called The Phantom Podcast. And then after 10 weeks, we went, never mind, it's called Attack of the Pod. Like, it was just like this floating thing.
But that also worked for the kind of absurdity
for
of the
joke.
Show. Right.
For the joke. But there like wasn't a consistent branding outside of just Griffin and David.
Right.
And so like a year in, we just go, I remember it was ironically Mad Max Fury Road, which ends up being like the perfect encapsulation of what a blank check movie is in the positive.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was having some allergic reaction to something, and I show up late to a screening where David had given me his plus one to go see that early, and we're amped for it. And I'm like all out in hives, but I had had the breakthrough, and I went like, I know what it is. The more we've been doing this show, the more we're just really fascinated by George Lucas and what this guy is trying to do. Like what his strategy was and how success affected him and the arcs of it and how you respond to criticism or wild success. Does the freedom help or hurt? All that stuff. And I was like, that's the thing. We just pick directors and it's that. We look at other people the way we look at Lucas, because as much as we thought we were looking at the Star Wars mythology, it really became about him.
Yeah.
So then, yeah, a year in, we changed the name of the thing. We changed the format. We changed everything. And, you know, like 200 people were irate.
Right.
How dare you?
Right.
It's schmoes. No, what? That's not what this is.
Right.
You know? And you go like, there's a natural evolution point now. I don't think there's a single person who goes like, I miss Griffin and David Presents. You know? There are people who go, the Star Wars stuff was my favorite, but it also, we had wrung that completely dry.
Sure.
And it was only through the process of doing essentially a different show for a year that we figured out what the other thing is.
Yeah.
And when people ask me for advice on starting things, be they like live streams or podcasts or whatever, that's always the advice I tell them is like, you need to be very willing to throw everything away.
Yep.
Either because it's not working or because something else is working more. And it's not a failure to like rip it up and rebuild it, because you sort of have to be light on your feet in that kind of way.
100%.
Yeah.
And I just went through that. I mean, I went to Schmodown, that channel.
Right.
Had everything on it, and it was the old Schmoes channel.
Right.
So it was a matter of, do I move all the Schmodown off of that channel and then try to build, because that is a harder kind of niche thing to do for people.
Yes, yes.
Or do I leave it there, try to get new viewers in there, and then take a new show and put it on a new channel and show people, hey, that thing that you used to like, I'm still doing that, but I'm doing it over here.
Yeah.
But you got to be willing, because tons of people are like, oh, you're separating us, too confusing, never going to work. Oh, moving it over Twitch, bad decision. And it's like, you have to trust in yourself. You got to trust in your gut. And you got to trust on who you're working with and who you're talking to.
Yes, that's huge. And I think also, I mean, I will say, I think I see some people occasionally fall into the trap of doing it too much, too far, separating things too much, changing them too much.
Yep.
Like, you need to pick your moments. But the thing, David and then Ben Hosley, our producer, like, the three of us love podcasts.
Yeah.
Aside from just we love movies talking about this stuff, we really love podcasting as a medium and we're fans of it for a really long time before we were doing a show, like early adopters.
Yeah.
So when we step back, aside from going, what seems to be connecting with people? What do we need to make sure we don't lose sight of? The other thing we do is, what are the podcasts we're listening to and what do we like in those shows and what turns us off?
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
You need to also step back and like be able to view it as an audience member. And go like, that's smart what they're doing.
Yeah.
And that's getting me deeper in versus this is starting to push me away.
It's also why though, because you're in the business obviously too, of being a successful actor and your brain does think that way too. Because not everybody there, I have a lot of friends that are just acting as their thing. That's what they do. That's what they focus on.
Sure.
You seem to have a lot more interest outside of that, producing, writing.
A lot of this stuff did not happen strategically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fell into it?
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, excuse me, not to go too far down the rabbit hole, but I thought I was going to just be a writer and director and not perform at all.
Yeah. Why not go down the rabbit hole? That's over here.
Yeah.
Might as well.
That's what I thought I was going to do. I was like a very performancey kid.
Yeah. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in New York City.
You did? In Manhattan?
In Manhattan.
Wow. Okay.
The Big Apple.
Yeah.
And I like desperately wanted to be a stage kid, like a showbiz kid. And
what
my parents
got you in, what,
did not want to. It was just like innate, immediate.
Yeah. What'd you see when you were growing up that made you say, oh shit, I want to do that?
I don't know. Like I try to go back to it, but it really is like, cause I feel people have that activation moment story.
Yeah.
And there's certainly things I can point to where it intensified,
yeah,
or where I got more focused on it, or I had a conception of how it was done or what I could do. But I also don't remember a single point in my life where that wasn't my impulse to do something. Like,
right.
I was the kid who would ask other kids' parents if I could perform at their birthday parties.
Sure.
You know, I'd be like, well, you hired a magician. I can do the magic tricks.
At how old?
Like 5, you know? And I was not good at magic.
Right.
You know, but I...
In your head, you were Copperfield.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, I had my, like, crappy rinky-dink kit or whatever, you know, or I want to do puppet shows or whatever it is. You know, I'd, like, beg teachers to let me, like, put on a play during lunch or whatever.
Yeah.
It was just, like, anytime I saw anyone performing, I got jealous.
Yeah.
And I wanted to find the opportunities to do that. But it was always through that prism of, like, wanting to be the guy, you know,
mm-hmm,
doing the thing,
mm-hmm,
in front of people. I mean, like, yeah, and just it was immediately the thing that I was all consumed by. And then when I got to high school,
yeah,
and the hormones hit, and I was very moody, and I wanted to be taken seriously,
yeah,
and I did not want to be a funny guy.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't see that.
It was, I mean.
How long did that last?
Well, here's the thing. I think throughout high school, I was fighting the fact that people viewed me as being funny. Where it was like, I want to make people laugh, and then I'm immediately hating the fact that I'm being pigeonholed into that.
Do you still feel that way sometimes?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't at all.
Okay.
I feel it 0% now.
Right.
I couldn't feel
you own it,
it
now.
Less.
Yeah.
Because I feel like most comedy people I know still have a little bit of like, I'd love to show them what I can do. And there's there's other stuff I'd like to do, but there is no part of me that cares about being seen as serious.
Yeah, you've embraced it, and you know it's a strength. But so,
right.
As it happens to all of us in high school, a lot of insecurities in there too.
It was all insecurity. Yourself. I think so much of it truly was I wanted girls to think I was attractive.
Right.
I think that was so much of it, and that
realizing that funny is a big weapon of attraction.
Sure, I mean I wasn't the right type of funny in high school to attract high school girls.
Like ripping farts off the side of a couch or something?
No, I think I was just kind of like Kramer. I was just like so bizarre.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Where I think a lot of people didn't view me as a person with interiority.
Right.
But it came out of discomfort.
Okay.
Right? Where it was like, I think in my early teen years, there was this, I'm weird. I don't want people to judge me.
Okay.
I would rather be weirder. So I am in control of what they think of me.
Sure.
You know? So I was, like, doing very dumb pranks in school.
Okay.
And doing dumb bits, you know?
Pranks on your friends or pranks on non-friends or...
It was, like, I would use, like, my classroom as, like, a performance space. And like,
I understand that. I've
like,
been there.
Like, here's, like, a dumb, completely, like, abstract to what end thing I remember doing. I was obsessed with Mondo.
Yeah.
Which was the, like the sugar water that comes in the plastic bottle where the bottle cap has to be ripped off of it. It's one solid, like, wax bottle piece. And it was, like, very cheap at the Rite Aid near my school. And so I bought it, and I just stocked up my locker. My locker was just Mondo. I didn't keep any books in there, right? It was like, I want to be the Mondo guy.
Right.
Like, I want to have something,
right?
It was so desperately I want to have any
it's the Mondo guy.
Reputation. I mean, it was like, no, I was a freshman at a new school.
Sure.
It's like 2 weeks in. I'm like, what if I'm the Mondo guy?
Yeah.
That gives me a hook.
You got a bit. You had a bit, right? You had a gimmick.
I want a gimmick.
You had a gimmick.
Right? And then I remember one day, people go, hey, throw me a Mondo. And I, you know, I hit the thing open. I throw him a Mondo or whatever. And it was just like, I have something.
Right.
I desperately need something. And history class, I gave everyone a Mondo and told them they had to open it at the exact same time and chug it. To no
meanwhile,
end.
Your parents are like, why is our bank account missing $4,000?
Right. Right. But like, that was the thing. I just thought it was funny if, in unison, every member of a class takes this thing out from under a desk, opens it, chugs it, slams it down, doesn't acknowledge it. And it was like, that was the kind of stuff I was doing.
Right.
Or like making like applause signs in class behind the teacher's head whatever.
But it's like, Kurt, you weren't a dick to people.
I wasn't a dick. I was incredibly bad academically.
Yeah.
So I was like constantly in danger of getting kicked out or held back or anything. And then on top of that, like, I'm doing these silly shenanigans, right. And teachers had varying levels of tolerance for it, understandably. I look back at it now, and I'm like, if I was a teacher, I would have been losing my goddamn mind.
I relate.
But at some point, that shifts to, now I built up too much of a reputation for just being, like, lunatic,
yeah.
Random guy.
Yeah.
I want everyone to take me very seriously. I'm very moody now. My heart's been broken.
Right.
Right. My heart's been broken by someone I never dated. Okay. And now right. I'm deep in my feels and listening to sad music, and I want everyone to take me seriously. So at that point, it was just like, I'm just writing, I'm directing, I never want to perform ever again. Performing is, like, lightweight, and it's silly.
Oh.
Even, like, you know, straight acting, yeah. Dramatic yeah. acting, yeah. I was just like, that's not, I'm an auteur. And I went to film school out here. I went to CalArts in Valencia.
Oh, okay. I didn't know
and
that.
I had this very set idea of, like, and I'm never going to be funny ever again.
Like, you're just going to shut it off.
Right. Not only do I not want to make explicitly comedic movies, right. But I also don't want to be a guy who makes jokes.
At all. Anywhere.
At least.
You're just going to be super serious. Why don't you be a doctor then?
Right. I was like, nothing above a casual sense of humor.
Right.
You know, I don't want there to be any more design on comedy. And I got there, and immediately it broke.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, I mean, whenever people try to suppress some innate side of their existence, their personality, it, like, comes out even bigger. And I was very miserable being there, and I liked writing and filmmaking and everything, but I also just found myself being more and more drawn to the performers at the school.
Yeah.
And being like, I like this. Why did I stop doing this?
Yeah.
You know? So I'd gotten lucky, and I had, like, met an agent who had at one point years earlier put me up for something because they were looking for kids. They couldn't find something. It was a movie that David O. Russell never ended up making with Vince Vaughn, and they were, like, searching for kids, and I, like, met this guy, and then he put me up for it, and they maybe put me up for one other thing. But I'm in college, and I'm miserable, and I email this guy cold, and I'm like, I don't know if you remember me, but I'm, like, here. I'm in L.A. I think I want to act again. I don't know if you guys want to put me up for anything. And he says his assistant, like, find something for him. They put me up for something. I go in, I work really hard. I lock myself in, like, the communal bathroom in the dorms.
Okay.
I skip all my classes the next day.
Wow.
You know, and a pre-ride share call, like, a town car to take me from Valencia.
Damn. To where?
To, I forget where. Yeah.
Farther enough away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. To go to this audition. And they were like, huh, that was good. Who are you? You have no thing. Yeah. What are you? And I was like, I'm just trying to act. And then they emailed me back and they were like, you had really good. So what? Like, the assistant was like, so what's your deal? And I was like, I don't know. I met him and I didn't think I wanted to do it. Now I think I do. Like, the next day, the writer strike starts. This is 2008.
Yes. Or 2007, right?
Yes. Correct. Yes. Yes.
That one I know very well.
Yes. 2007. So I drop out beginning of 2008. I tried going back the next semester and I was just like, I'm done.
Yeah.
Right.
The bug came back.
I moved back to New York. Yeah. This assistant's in New York. But when I came back for the holidays, I got, I met up with the assistant at a diner. And I was like, I really think I want to drop out and take this really seriously. And start, like, seriously doing comedy and acting.
Okay.
And I would take this as seriously as you would take me. And he was like, I'm an assistant, but I'm very driven. And I want to, like, make my bones. And it would be beneficial to me to, like, have a hip-pocketed client that I can figure out how to develop someone.
Yeah.
So we sort of, like, guinea-pigged each other, and I dropped out and just started auditioning for everything and doing open mics and having sketch groups with friends and all that sort of stuff. He's still my agent to this day.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I was going to ask. But but you had mentioned earlier that your parents weren't into the theater stuff in general, right?
Yeah.
You doing that. So then what is their reaction when you say, hey, I'm dropping out of school and I'm just going after acting and comedy?
Yeah. Well, so my mother was a... I say this with judgment, but I think she would admit as such, a not entirely successful actor.
Okay.
She had a real run at that, and I think it just hit a real point of frustration, and then, had me, and I ruined everything.
She doesn't feel that way, does she?
No. I mean, but I was just the first. She had two kids after that.
Right.
She clearly, she tripled down on it, but I was the first one that sort of put the acting career on ice. But so she comes from that. And her mother, by the way, was an unsuccessful actress.
Okay.
And then her biological father.
So you're in a long line of unsuccessful actors and actresses. So, but as much as we're kind of bringing this up, though.
Yeah.
Does that play inside of your head?
Absolutely. Oh, that's why I'm bringing all this up. And then, right, my biological grandfather was a novelist who tried very hard to become a Hollywood screenwriter, couldn't really connect.
Right.
And then my grandmother remarried. The man who mostly raised my mother was, like, a French character actor who, like, worked but had a reasonable, was not rich, you know, was in some big movies in small parts, had larger parts in tiny movies, was never a very famous known quantity,
right?
And lived a modest actor life. And then my father desperately wanted to be a sportscaster. That was, like, all he wanted to do. And he tried it and, like, felt like he failed. Like, he had his, like, Albert Brooks. You finally get the audition and the sign collapses and you're flop sweating. And you realize you don't play on camera. And then didn't really know what to do and was, like, very much kind of, like, you know, young entrepreneur looking for quick money sort of stuff. And he, there was a regular bar he went to that was owned by, like, an old boxing corner man.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other guys who went there was this guy who was a game show producer. And he told my dad, like, Showtime just started, this new channel. They want to differentiate themselves from HBO by filming plays.
Okay.
If you can get the contracts for a play to be filmed, we'll give you the finder's fee. So my dad started, he had a briefcase that was empty other than Pepto-Bismol because incontinence runs in my family. And he would, like, literally slip in through backstage doors and pretend to be some official of any status to try to get people to sign over the rights so that he could get them over and make the thing. And the one he was successful with was Robert Altman's first and I believe only play he ever did on Broadway, Back to the Five and Dine, Jimmy Dean.
That's got a Biff Loman thing going on there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But that movie was Cher and Karen Black and Sandy Dennis. It was like big movie stars on Broadway with this big director post Popeye. So he was like at his lowest point.
Sure.
And my dad breaks in and is like, well, I'm going to sell it to Showtime. And Robert Altman's like, who the fuck are you? Get out of here. Am I allowed to curse?
Yeah.
Who the fuck are you? Get out of here. You're a kid. This could be the biggest show in history. It's going to run for 20 years. Get out of here. And then the show opens and it bombs. It gets the worst reviews. It's going to close within 2 nights. My dad goes back in again and is like, hey, offer still stands. And he's like, didn't you read the reviews? And he's like, we could sell this. And Altman was like, I'll use this kid. I'll get in the door at Showtime. I'll get them to double our budget. We'll move the set from the show onto a soundstage. Wow. I'll rejigger the whole thing as a movie.
Yeah.
And my dad ends up getting grandfathered in as like associate producer to that and accidentally becomes a producer and was an independent film producer for like 30 some odd
years.
And
that was his way in.
Yes.
Wow.
But
that's a cool story.
Kind of hated it.
Did he?
That's the other thing. It's like, so there's the side of my family that all wanted to do it and had this very realistic, pragmatic sense of like, it's very hard and it doesn't really work out.
Right.
And then my father, that was not his passion. He sort of fell into it by accident and it kind of drove him crazy.
Yeah.
Because it's a tough industry and
you gotta love it.
You either have to love it
or
you kind of just have to be a power, money, fame, hungry monster.
Which you still have to love that too, though.
You have to love that.
You gotta love one of the two. Yeah.
Right. And he was a pretty modest guy who I think his ultimate goal was I would love to find my filmmakers who I could help and protect and do this.
Yeah.
And he had people he worked with a couple times, but then maybe they'd go off and do the bigger movie without him or their career wouldn't really pan out or whatever it was. Right. And he did it for like 30 some odd years. And then one of his friends who he had worked with early in his career had been made the dean of the film program at Tisch and called him in to be a guest speaker.
Yeah.
And I went to watch my dad do this, and I was like, this is the happiest I've ever seen him in my entire life.
Yeah.
And he was like, I'm done. I'm just teaching full time.
Yeah.
And he's been teaching for the last 20 years now, and it's like,
and that's what he loves.
Infinitely happier, and it's sort of like, I can use all of my failed experiences, you know, everything I did wrong to help these people, and he's very hands-on and like really invested in them. And he's
Parents still together?
Tricky question.
Okay.
But yeah, you know, there's that aspect of it too, where it's like, here's a side of the family that really wanted to be in it and couldn't find their way in.
Right.
And then here's a guy who got his way in and couldn't wait to get out.
Sure.
And so their disapproval of it was a lot of like,
it's like protection more so.
Exactly. Yeah. As opposed to, I think a lot of parents who don't want their kids going into this, it's because it's like, what is this? This isn't real.
No,
get a real job.
They've been there before.
They knew.
It bit them or they had success and didn't like it.
Right.
So they were saying, listen, trust us. We've been there before. Stay away from it.
All right.
But that's still in the same neighborhood,
absolutely,
though, because it's like, you got to figure it out yourself.
Absolutely. And it was, you know, they didn't want me to go to art school. They wanted me to go to a place where I could get a more well-rounded education.
Sure.
But My grades were terrible.
Yeah.
My reel was good. I only got into art schools.
Right.
I went to the most bubbly kind of conservatory school, which they weren't happy with in the first place. And then when 6 months later I call them and go, I'm dropping out, they're less happy about that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I was sort of doing everything wrong in their eyes because they wanted everything kind of buttressed with some security plan or backup. And I think the acting thing felt even more frivolous to them than the writing directing thing, where at least there was more of an ability to self-start there.
Yeah, you're and you said you have, so you have a brother and a sister?
Correct. Yeah, oldest three.
And so are they into this at all?
I mean they like it. My brother works in sports and my sister works in food.
Okay. So you're really the first one to go out there and from everything you just told me, succeed, like really succeed, not including your dad from what your dad did producing,
yes,
but inside of acting, and yes.
Yeah, you know, within relative terms, yeah. I mean, just the fact that I've been able to work and do things, you know, it's only with distance, because I just went into it with such singular tunnel vision of like, you know, a lot of it was also very pragmatic for me, where I was like, I don't want to be in school, I hate being here. I want to be working.
Yeah.
No one is specifically looking to hire a 19-year-old screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
But I am 19 and I look young. I can work 15 at adult hours.
Right.
So I kind of knew, like, there was an entrance for me into, there are a lot of parts I can audition for right away.
Yeah.
Even though I didn't go to Juilliard. Even though I don't have credits, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I just have this window I can exploit.
Yeah.
And an agent who's very willing, I mean, he was an assistant at this time, very willing to put me up for everything. And his whole thing he said to me, which was incredible advice, was just, I'm going to put you up for everything. I'm going to put you in front of every casting director in New York City. And you just have to work as hard as you did for that first audition we brought you in for in LA. Because even if you're wrong for it, just impress them so you're in their mind and they bring you back for the stuff you are right for.
Sure.
Yeah, so I just was like auditioning non-stop.
That's pretty great, especially when you're starting out there and you need that confidence to get there, because you're very good in a room, obviously. You're good talking with people, and that was one of the things when I got out here, like stand up was my thing, right?
Right.
And I would go out on auditions and I fucking hated it.
Stand up I came to later, sort of.
See, stand up was the thing that was mine.
Yeah.
But like I hated auditioning. I just never fit into it. It's like, as you know from doing stand up, for me what I love about stand up is that you call the shots. You cast what is said. That no one can tell you. You bomb, that's on you.
Right.
You do great, it's on you.
Yeah.
In that room, there's a lot of different things going on in that casting room. It's a lot of different things in
there. There are a lot of weird variables.
Yes.
I got strangely good at it. I mean, it's a funny thing where, like, I feel like for a long time I was particularly good at auditioning.
Yeah.
And then when I would get jobs, I would flounder a little bit. Because it was such a different thing. I had sort of, as a survival mechanism, learned how to get very good at popping in that room and connecting people and doing what would, you know, make a splash there.
Yeah.
But that's very different from actually acting.
Yeah.
You know, from having to work with another person and react off of them and be in the moment and be flexible and also contend with, you know, acting on camera is like 30% about acting as an art form and 70% about problem solving, how you do your art around all these technical problems.
Right.
Because I think the thing people don't understand, and I think it's very stupid, but like most acting schools and classes and programs do not really prep people for this. And even when there are acting for camera classes, they tend to just be feel your light, know your angle stuff.
Right.
But the thing they don't prep you for, which you have to learn on the job, and if you're a person who gets really good at auditioning, it's maybe because you've practiced the thing 800 times in a mirror and you have this one fixed perfect thing you can do.
Right.
And the reader is not giving you much, so you're just going off of yourself and whatever. But then you get there and you've practice it and you run it the way you want to, and they go, actually, now because of this is that, so you need to be sitting there, and also can you yell all of your lines rather than whisper them, because we have this background noise or whatever it is. And I would like kind of crumble a little bit, you know,
because you prepped one particular thing and then it just has to switch it on the fly.
Right So as I got better at understanding the process of how to actually do the job, I feel like I've gotten worse at auditioning, because they are almost such counter things.
Two different skills.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so what's the first gig, though, that you, so now that you've had this, now that you have the agent, and now that he's sending you in on everything, what's the first job?
The first job I did was, the first real thing was a pilot for Showtime that Tim Robbins directed.
Okay.
And
that,
it was
big ass deal.
It was a big deal. It was a small part in it, but it was a small part that would recur.
It's your first job and Tim Robbins is directing it.
Huge.
That's massive.
And it was like Josh Lucas and Ellen Burstyn and Tim Blake Nelson.
That's
it was this crazy stacked cast.
Yeah. That's not like a cat food commercial.
It was big. You know, I was doing student films and college humor videos and, you know, like all the things that pay you negative money, you know, where you have to do your own makeup and whatever.
Yeah.
But that was like my first real legitimate job I'd gotten from auditioning.
Yeah.
And I was just like, well, I'm set.
Right.
What are you talking about? Show it to Tim Robbins?
Right. I got it.
I'm the stoner kid. Right. Like, great. I'm in it, you know? And then the show didn't get picked up.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get arrested for a while. And it was that thing of like, you know, I go through like a year of auditioning. I get that part and I go like, oh, finally.
Yeah.
And I remember my mom saying to me, like, don't say finally.
Right.
People work a lot longer and a lot harder than you have to get their first job. You should not feel entitled to getting this after a year. You're moving faster than most people.
It's funny. You mentioned your mom beforehand, too.
Yeah.
As you were saying, you know, that even she would say that it just didn't work out for her.
Right.
But she almost sounds like your Yoda. When it comes to the acting side of it.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Not always, but I mean, certain very key moments like that.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, I thought like, well, now I'm in it.
Right.
And it took a while for anything else to happen. You know, for a while there, the jobs were very spread out. I did a teen movie with Ezra Miller and Zoe Kravitz.
Oh, wow.
And this was like, well, they're the next two big stars.
Yeah.
Jesse McCartney was the bully in it.
Yeah.
And I was like the booger, right?
Okay.
Right, it was Ezra was the lead, Zoe was the love interest, Jesse McCartney was the villain.
What's
and then
the name
I was
called?
It was called Beware the Gonzo.
Okay.
And I was the ducky, I think my character's name was Horny Rob, right?
Horny
I was
Rob.
Like the wacky best friend.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, "Well, this is just going to explode. Like this is, you know, look at they're obviously movie stars."
Yeah.
You know, it was like they're clearly going to be superheroes inevitably.
Yeah, right.
You know, we have this current pop star in this thing. There were so many actors in the supporting cast of that movie who have also become big deals in different ways. Like Colby Minfey, who's on The Boys now.
Okay.
Like, the cast of that was just incredibly overqualified. But I was, like, the funny character in that. And it was, like, very shortly after Superbad, and everyone was like,
this is it. Slam dunk.
Right. And then it's just like, you know, it plays at Tribeca, and it gets released straight to DVD, and it doesn't make any mark. And it's like, then it's another year before...
Okay.
You know, you do a guest spot on this thing, you do that, whatever.
But you have, so that there's that Showtime one with Robbins. You're like,
got
it, boom,
got
doesn't
it.
Go.
Right.
Then you have to wait, you finally get this thing.
Right.
It's going to be massive, straight to DVD.
Right,
so
nothing.
Does the confidence waver at this point, and you go, okay, maybe this is a bad decision, or
absolutely.
Keep going?
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a bit of sunk cost fallacy.
What? Did I say it again?
Sunk cost fallacy,
I think.
You know, and stubbornness and not wanting to give it up, but I'm terrified. I do not feel confident about this.
Right.
You know, there is a point of just like, I feel like I know how it could happen and what I could do, but I'm really questioning whether or not it's going to go there, you know? And it's like working like day jobs in retail, quitting whenever I get a job, then going like, I'm set, and then I don't work for 9 months,
right.
And I'm stretching out that one paycheck as far as I can or whatever.
And you're
living
in the city.
Living in the city.
Right.
I got very good at living very thrifty.
Right.
Still,
that hurts your confidence too, though.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. You know, I think it would have been harder for me out here just because there is a perspective you can get in New York because it is an industry town, because it's so many different industries that, like, no one really gives a shit about you.
Right.
You know?
Also,
whereas
you live there and it's also comfortability.
There's the comfort and all of that.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, when I'm out here, anytime I would, like, come out here to do general meetings and auditions or whatever, and I'm, like, doing, like, lift share, you know, everyone wants to compare notes on which things they've gone up for.
Right.
And I liked that in New York. Like, I had a couple actor friends, but most of my friends were outside of that. And it was just like, this is my job.
Right.
And my entire life is not centered around it, despite the fact that I'm very obsessive about it.
Sure.
And then I'd say, like, the point where things started happening for me weirdly was, you know, I was doing odds and ends and stuff. Nothing really hit or got seen or whatever. I would get close to a lot of big stuff. That was the thing that kind of gave me the encouragement to keep going, is that I would get very far along.
Yeah.
I would be meeting with directors.
Yeah.
And then they'd go, they really like you, just not right for this,
right.
You know? And I would go, like, well, if enough prestigious people have said that to me,
yeah,
I shouldn't give up on this.
Right.
It's making me feel like I was close to getting in Scott Pilgrim.
Okay.
As young Neil.
Okay.
The Johnny Simmons role.
Yeah.
And then, like, I'm trying to think of other ones I was close for. But that was, like, a big one for me. That's where great. I was, like, yeah. You know.
And you've got to be a massive Edgar Wright fan. Yeah, you seem like I love Edgar Wright myself.
Huge fan of those books and everything. I was working at Forbidden Planet, which is a comic book store.
Yeah.
It is a comic book store in New York City at the time. And I just, like, I was in the mix, and it was down to, like, me and two other guys for, like, months.
Right.
And I just every day would like work and then go on my lunch break and turn my phone on and wait for the text that was, you got the part, so I could go up to them and go, I quit. I'm in an Edgar Wright movie.
Right.
You know, which is like the dream to go like at a comic book store and go like, I'm in Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah.
You'll never see me again. You know?
Right.
And instead, I quit when I got the Tim Robbins show and then the show didn't go. And they were like, what happened to that guy?
Yeah.
Didn't he tell us he was going to be a TV star?
Right.
Right. I did... Just for Laughs Montreal.
Oh, okay.
I sort of started, I had a sketch group for a while,
yeah.
Then that disbanded. I started focusing on stand-up.
Yeah.
I did like a one-man show that was sort of like a character-y sketch thing. And some of the Montreal scouts had come to see that, and they were like, you should do stand-up. They said, do you do stand-up?
Yeah.
And I said, yes, of course I do stand-up, and started doing stand-up the next day.
Right.
Because they didn't really have a character zone at that point.
Okay.
You know, they would have sketch groups perform.
Yeah.
And for people who don't know, JFL is like kind of the big comedy festival.
Yeah.
For a long time was like the place that single-handedly made people. Now everything's become more spread out.
The internet changed a lot of things. But it was in Montreal. It was funny that during like the 80s, 70s, 80s, it was all talk shows. It was Johnny Carson.
Right.
It was this, and then, yes, the Just for Laughs in Montreal was massive.
And the pipeline for a while was, you know, they're sending scouts to clubs.
Yeah.
They're picking people who don't even have reps.
Right.
They're going and performing in front of industry in Montreal, and then they're now getting sitcom deals or late night appearances.
Right.
And now it's like the people who get into Montreal tend to have already been on TV several times.
Yeah.
You know, it's a far more sort of,
right.
It's a lot more of a
sounds machinery. Like YouTube.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. But they didn't have like solo stuff, so I started working on stand-up a lot.
Yeah.
To get good enough to get passed by them because I knew I was on their radar.
Sure.
And then by the time I'd gotten good enough at stand-up, they were like, well, now we're doing characters as well. Do you want to audition for characters and doing like solo sketch stuff?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I haven't done that in 4 years because I threw everything away trying to do the stand-up stuff.
Right.
But I went in and did that and got through.
Yeah.
And so I did Montreal, and that sort of gave me a little bit of juice. You know, I was in a year with like Rachel Bloom and Lauren Lapkus and Sam Richardson and all these people who had blown up.
Yeah.
I did not pop there, but it got me in front of some people who then gave me certain jobs.
And it sharpens the tools.
Sharpens the tools.
Yeah.
And then I got an email for an audition that was a Paramount Pictures Untitled Brothers project.
Okay.
And the sides that they send, it's like, oh, this is clearly some fake, you know, dummy title thing.
Yeah.
The sides that they send are four brothers named Ralph, Donald, Leonard, and Michael fighting about why they let a woman into the sewers with them.
Right.
I was like, well, I know what this is. Right?
Yes.
And I'll tell the story as quickly as I can.
Yeah, please.
But I was not a Ninja Turtles kid growing up.
Okay.
That wasn't my thing. And my mom was very overprotective and didn't let me watch most things.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff that I came back around to later. Like, you know, once I had a little bit of autonomy, I was all in on Marvel and Batman and He-Man and all these things. But like TNT, I just kind of fully missed, along with Power Rangers and a couple other big ones from my generation. So I had like almost no frame of reference outside of just osmosis, what the Turtles are.
Sure.
My brother was this big sports kid, and he would always, like, he had so much energy. He was, like, the Tasmanian devil.
Yeah.
He's a little guy like me.
Okay.
He's more built than I am, but, like, he's short. He's a short Jew, right?
Yeah.
And he was just a really prodigious athlete, despite not having the body for it.
Sure.
And he had so much energy as a kid. He always, like, wanted to, like, if my friends had parents over for dinner, he'd want them to, like, play basketball with him in his bedroom with his little hoop on the door.
Yeah.
He just was so competitive. And so when there was downtime, he would, like, mime playing sports with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as a little kid, he would, like, be shadow boxing or, like, playing
That's
defense
awesome.
Against
yeah.
someone who wasn't there. Like,
yeah.
he was just constantly practicing as if someone was coming at him,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And in the sides for the Ninja Turtles thing, they were, like, runt of the litter. He's got the complex. He wants to prove that he's tough. That was their take on this new Michelangelo. This was for the Michael Bay thing about 10 years ago, I guess now. And I was like, I don't know a lot, but the way they're describing this, at least in this version, sounds a lot like my brother.
Yeah.
I'm just going to play it like this. The sides are like a page. It's like five lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
But my choice I made was he is just acting like he's fighting ninjas the whole time.
Right.
Right? It's he's got this, let me at him, let me at him. Just sort of like he's trying to overcompensate for his lack of size. And I do that. I'm in New York. I know the main casting's happening in LA. I'm meeting with a satellite person who's putting me on tape. Out of mind, right?
Yeah,
Like, I almost didn't do it. I was like, why waste my time doing this?
Sure.
And then they call back the next day. My manager calls back, and he was like, get ready. They're going to put you on a plane. They want you to play one of the Turtles.
Wow, that's awesome.
And I was like, what?
Yeah.
So they fly me out. I have, like, maybe 24 hours in between where I get my friends who are Ninja Turtles obsessive, and I'm like, crash course. Teach me everything, right? We're watching first movie, the first two episodes of each of the series at that point. I'm reading the comics and everything. And the more I'm getting into that, I'm like, what I just did in that audition does not compute with any of this other stuff.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And I don't know what they're looking for, really.
Maybe it's the energy.
They haven't, they haven't let me read the script. It's all under lock and key.
Okay.
So I get out to LA and, you know, they put me in a room. I sign all the NDAs with it was nine guys going up for eight roles. Is that right? Yes. It was two guys for each part and three guys for Michelangelo.
Got it.
But it's the four guys who ultimately got it, and then one alternate for each, and then, me. And I read the script, and I'm just like, I don't know what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
So I call up the casting director, who I had not spoken to, and I go, like, I just, like, lay cards out on the table. I didn't grow up with this. I don't really know this. I'm a big fan of other stuff. Now I've done this deep dive, and I realize how incompatible what I did is with any previous version of the character. Can you tell me what the director responded to just so I know what I should be doubling down on?
Yeah.
And she said he really liked your methy vibe.
Your methy vibe?
And I went, oh, like method, like the method actor? And they went, no, that you seemed like you were on meth. That you were like doing like a Jesse Pinkman sort of like freak out thing.
Oh, that's great.
And she went, by the way, don't tell anyone that you don't know this.
Right,
like
right.
Everything you just said to me, never repeat that ever again.
Right.
But just like he like a lot of people were playing it safe. In retrospect, it now makes sense that you were the one person who wasn't beholden to doing an impression of the thing you grew up loving.
Right.
Right? Which I've later now gotten to do that. But this was a case where I was going in pretty clean.
Sure.
And he was like, he just liked that you were doing something very different than everyone else and taking big swings and whatever. So I go in there and we're doing like, they're just sending us in. It's hours and hours of like one and a half page scene.
Sure.
And different permutations, different configurations of, let's see these four, who have the best chemistry,
right.
All of that. And the other guys are going like, man, crazy work, and you really like. And I was like, am I this good of an actor? And in retrospect, they're just like, man, I can't believe this guy is sabotaging this hard. They're never going to hire him. This is way too weird.
Yeah.
Because I'm just going like weirder and weirder and weirder with it.
It's back to your high school thing.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then the director is like, because he's like trying, you know, see different things.
Yeah.
And he goes, Griffin, do you think you could play neurotic? And I went, look, I spent 12 hours last night in a hotel room trying to knock all the neuroses out of my system.
Yeah.
If you open this bottle, you're not getting the toothpaste back in the tube.
Did you say that? You said that?
I did. I said, like, I can do this, but it's once we go there, it's not going to be able to pull back.
Yeah.
And he was like, yes, let's do, you're bold. That's why I brought you out here. You're bold. Let's do it. And so I do that, and I start doing neurotic, and he's like, yes, more, more. So it elevates the point where I'm having panic attacks and retreating into my shell and all this stuff, and everyone's like, this is so cool. I walk out of there. I call my agents. I call my parents. I'm like, I'm getting this. Everyone just – I'm like Jack Sparrow. I'm doing this outro performance in a blockbuster movie. I'm undeniable. And then like 3 days later, they call, and they're like, absolutely not. You know, the director was into it, the casting director was into it, and then they show it to the executives, and they're just like, what?
Right.
In what world? He's the party dude.
Right.
Like, he's the fun one.
Right.
We have to sell bath towels here. Like, you can't do something this odd. But getting that close for that part was the thing that actually got me momentum in the industry for the first
time. Great story, this.
It was that weird thing of just then that everyone went, oh, this guy almost got a Ninja Turtle. They don't know what happened in the tape or why I was turned down, But it's like, here's an unknown guy, and he almost got this big part.
Right.
So then I started for the first time. I had like a pilot season where I tested for multiple things, sure. And then I got one, and then that didn't go, and it got retooled. But it sort of just led to other things and other things. I did Draft Day, the movie. That came out of like this run where I just sort
underrated
of...
Underrated movie.
I'm a fan.
Me too.
I like it a lot. I don't know anything about sports, so I think I'm more willing to forgive.
You know, the sports part of it is really good.
Yeah.
But that's why I actually like it, because it can't, for someone who's not into sports,
yes.
it doesn't rely on you having to know everything that's going on.
No, yeah. it's a bit more of a fantasy.
It
you
is.
Know?
We have a lot more to talk about.
Yes.
We have Masters of the Universe, we have The Tick, we have more to talk about, but I also wanted to let you guys know, if you didn't, and I've been talking about it, I've been raving about it, and I don't know if Griffin knows about it, but he should, and Cuts. Cuts is it's such a great brand. I'm so excited to be working with them again. And if you guys didn't already know, the sport of business, for you guys, what it means, it's demanding excellence from your craft and your wardrobe. Your fits need to be versatile. You got to blend timeless style and comfort so that you look as good as you feel. And if you didn't know that, now you do. And then you have Cuts Clothing for that reason. They have taken a classic men's fashion staple, just a plain t-shirt. They refined it, combining premium quality with a minimalistic aesthetic. You got cut shirts, polos, hoodies. I have told you every time about these hoodies. It is getting cold in Los Angeles, and it is literally just waiting for me to put on and run around outside. It is so comfortable. I love this thing. And if you didn't know enough about Cuts, in 2016, Cuts founder Steve Borelli, he set out to create clothes ready for every occasion that the modern man faces. He started by reinventing the t-shirt. And what happened when he did that? GQ, they call it, is the only shirt worth wearing. If you haven't checked it out, you really should. It is the perfect t-shirt. And consider the new Cuts hoodie that I've been talking about, where they developed Hyperloop French Terry fabric, a textile that the temperature alone, it is controlled and it's ageless. You will never have to take it off, and you certainly won't want to. Each piece of clothing is designed with a custom engineered fabric, expertly graded for the perfect fit, arming you for every challenge and opportunity. It's not just a lifestyle. It's not just clothing. It's office, leisure, apparel for the sport of business. You can get 15% off of your first order, and all you have to do is go to cutsclothing.com/SENLive. cutsclothing.com/SENLive. Get 15% off the only shirt worth wearing. Have you tried the Cuts?
I have not, but okay. I'm sold.
I need to get you in touch.
Yeah, please do.
Because they are phenomenal. But all right, jumping back into this.
Yeah.
Because you start going on pilot season, start, and now because of that experience where that is a big shift to where you approach it one way, they tell you go neurotic, you go inside of a place that you don't want to go to, but to get it, and then they go, everybody in the room loving what you're doing.
Not going to happen.
Right, but what it does is open doors. So what is, so does that ultimately get you down the path of the Tick, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long circuitous path, which is I get a job working for MTV as a correspondent on a show they were doing called Nikki and Sarah Live.
Okay.
Which was them sort of trying to do a, like, pop culture daily show.
Sure.
Which I thought the show was very funny, and MTV kind of mucked it up the more as it went along.
Yeah.
But I became their in-house correspondent.
Yeah.
So I was...
Many careers have been built off that.
Yes. And I enjoyed it. I had a lot of creative authorship in those segments.
Sure.
We did two scripted in-studio segments, and I did two remote pieces. I found both processes very fun.
Yep.
The in-studio stuff was actually live, and then the remote stuff was fun because you just get to throw stuff at the wall and, you know, whatever. Enjoyed doing that. Then I test for a couple pilots in a row. Didn't get. It's that thing where it's like, but then the momentum's building. This stupid thing in the industry that, like, not getting jobs can get you further than getting jobs.
Right, yeah.
Because it makes people go like, oh, why were they interested in this guy? Let's like take a look at him, right? Can we pick him up on the rebound or whatever? And then I get the pilot I end up getting is John Mulaney's sitcom for NBC.
Okay.
Which was like this big, big deal thing at the time. And I'm the only non-famous person in the cast. Yeah. And that show kind of implodes for a number of reasons. A lot of, I think, really stupid meddling.
Yeah.
I think the pilot we made was good.
Network meddling?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the pilot we made was good. I think the script he wrote is, for my money, still the funniest pilot I've read. It's like incredible.
Yeah.
And then it ended up being maybe 50% of that. Okay. And then it was caught up in a weird transitional period at NBC.
Mm-hmm.
And they just sort of shrugged it off.
Sure.
And I had other stuff. Like, I had gotten draft day off of that momentum. I was sort of, like, moving forward, but that distracted me from the burn of that falling apart, which was really like, oh, this is, like, a dream job.
Yeah.
You know, like, I was on the live studio audience sitcom set, sitting on a couch with, like, some of the funniest people, you know, Mulaney, but, like, Martin Short. Ellie Gould is one of my acting idols. And I was like, this is the dream. I would love to do this for 10 years.
Yes.
Right? Like, this is all I want to do. And then when that falls apart, I'm too distracted with other jobs. And then when the work, that momentum, that run starts to dry up, Fox picks up Mulaney and turnaround and retools it, and I'm dropped. Everyone else is still on.
And they just cut you?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was like a specific Fox note.
That they got to get rid of Griffin Newman.
I don't know how much it was focused on.
Do you know why?
Yeah, I don't
want to say.
That's
fine. That's fine.
Because of
why get yourself in trouble?
It's not even that. It's it's the other people.
Okay.
You know.
So maybe if I can.
I can't say why they fired me without insulting other people.
You don't have to. And I'll theorize. Theorize that somebody on side of the set maybe wasn't vibing with you, and then they complained.
No, it wasn't that. It was a thing where I think the head of Fox at that point in time said this character should not be this. It should be this.
Okay.
Right?
We don't want the neurotic Ninja Turtle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just fundamentally, this is not funny.
Right.
And it didn't even sound like it was focused at that guy's not funny. It was like, I don't want this type of character existing in this thing.
Sure.
Which, in a way, was more of a rejection because I read this and I go, this is the character I've always wanted to play my entire life.
Right.
Right? Then I get it on a show that's like a dream. And the network is like, this character shouldn't exist on television.
Right.
So it wasn't just a rejection.
Now I want to know about the character.
Simon Rich, who's like an incredible comedy writer, Miracle Workers and A Man Seeking Woman.
Sure.
A bunch of other things. Okay. Has written several books. Yes. It was based on him.
Okay.
It was just, I mean, in that original iteration of the show, the character both sort of functioned as Costanza and Kramer.
Okay.
And was incredibly weird. He was a little bit like how I behaved in high school.
Hence why you wanted to play him so bad.
The description was, which I just thought was incredible.
Right.
And when I read this, just in the breakdown, I was like, if I don't get this part, I'm going to lose my mind.
Yeah.
It was a broken child prodigy, a broken prodigy in the body of a Dust Bowl child.
Okay.
And the idea for the character was that he was like a child genius who graduated early, went to college when he was like 14, got assigned roommates with Mulaney and Nassim Pedrad's character, and they, like, broke him. Like, once he got to college, he had never socialized. He had just been this child prodigy. Yeah. And then he gets there, and he discovers beer, and he's never amounted to anything in his life. He plays online poker. He tells people he's a cartoonist, but he's never been published. He's always got these get-rich-quick schemes.
Perfect for this role.
Right, but he still acts like he's a special kid.
Yeah.
He hasn't gotten out of that even in his late 20s, right? Or mid-20s, whatever it was. So I, like, loved it. I thought it was so funny, so much fun to do. And then the network being like, no part of this should exist.
Yeah.
And every other character got retooled, but retooled in a way that the same actors could still play it.
Sure.
And my character got retooled, and then the whole thing got rejiggered in a way where they were like, they fundamentally just don't want your type in this.
Ugh.
That's the Fox note, right? Yeah. So now work has dried up again.
Right.
And I'm like really now feeling the long tail burn of that.
Yeah.
And living with the fear of, is this going to become Friends? Am I going to be the guy who got dropped from Friends?
Right.
Is that going to haunt me for the rest of my life?
Missing Beetle.
Because especially in the New York comedy scene, I'm going back to doing bar shows, right?
Yeah.
And people are going, oh my God, you're the guy in the Mulaney thing, right? Isn't that huge? And I go like, they fired me like 9 months ago. I'm back to doing unpaid bar shows for two people in a basement.
Right.
You know? I get a part on Vinyl, the HBO Scorsese show, which is like a huge thing, but it's a tiny part. And it's a tiny part in a pilot where I get to be directed by Scorsese. Best experience in the world.
Bobby Cannavale, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, crazy. Ray Romano, Olivia Wilde, wild nuts cast. So, like, fun to be part of that circus. It's a tiny role. And they're like, if the show gets picked up, it'll turn into something. It's like The Office. You're Stanley. We'll figure out.
Right.
We need four more people in The Office. I had auditioned for a part that my friend Jack Quaid got, and deservedly got, was, like, the right guy for it. And they brought in people they had seen for other roles and were like, we don't have anything for you, but we can offer you this and they'll figure out something
right
for you to do.
Right.
And so I did the pilot. That was a great experience. And then that's happening while Mulaney's being reshot and retooled, and I'm living in the shadow of the fear of that,
sure,
or whatever.
Sure.
And then when it goes to season, it just never really turns into anything. I'm essentially a very well-paid featured extra on an incredible overqualified set.
Right.
Where it's like, this is educational, but I'm not really acting anymore.
Right.
And a couple of years ago, I had Heat, and I don't anymore. And this was the time I came closest to being like, maybe I should, like, hang it up.
Right.
And my thought was, I'll just go all in on stand-up. I don't really need to do this anymore. It feels like I had my moment. Maybe I blew it, you know?
You know, if you... So, wait. So, if you were... When you said your stand-up, were you ever... Because you were talking about how you went to the rooms and you were... Did you ever feel like maybe you just pursue stand-up?
At that moment,
quitting acting because of if this Mulaney thing isn't working out, then...
Yeah, I just felt so frustrated by all of it, and it felt like, should I be reading the tea leaves, you know?
Yeah.
It felt like, did I get called up to the majors, and they told me, actually, you don't have what it takes.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I sort of went like,
because at that time, that thought where you say maybe it's just the character alone, you do feel like it's
me. Of course.
Right.
Of course. And by the way, it wasn't what you guessed, but I am every night going, did that person not like me? Could I have been nicer on set? Could I have been funnier on set? Could I have networked more? Like, all of it.
Right.
It's just, I'm staying awake at night, just running through all of it. And, like, Draft Day has come out and bombed. You know, like, there's sort of, like, the other stuff I did didn't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
It's the MTV show gets canceled. Like, I had all this heat, and then it all felt like it sort of dissipated. And now I'm on this big HBO show, getting to spend nice time on set, and, like, maybe every other episode have one line. I mostly sit in the background, I smoke a cigarette, right?
Right.
And it's like, this is fun as an experience, but maybe I need to, like, sort of holster my acting ambition.
Sure.
I felt like I was getting really good at stand-up,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, this year is, I'm going to work on, like, getting up to being a guy who can do an hour, who can headline, who can this and that.
Sure. How long were you doing at the time?
I up until that point, was not doing more than, like, 15, 20 minutes, and that year was like, I'm going to build this up.
Yeah.
And I was able to, like, headline Caroline's one night and do, like, an hour and be able to start doing hours where I felt like, oh, and I didn't even use that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I had extra material that wasn't being used. I wasn't sweating to get to an hour.
Right.
So I felt good about that. And that was really, my mind was like, I think Vinyl had been picked up for a second season.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this is a day job.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This day job, contractually, I found myself in this good position. This is a fun work environment. Yeah. I don't really have to do anything as an actor.
Right.
I just have a mustache and I smoke a cigarette in the background and that's it. Right?
Right.
But, like, nice work if you can get it. I don't really want to be auditioning for other stuff. I'm happy to have this. And otherwise, I like all energy. I now have an hour. I want to focus on.
So you're coasting in acting and making sure that and really focusing on stand-up.
That was my thought.
Yeah.
And I draft an email to my agents to just say, like, Final got renewed. I don't need to pursue anything else. Don't put me up for anything. Yeah. I want to spend a year where I just focus on stand-up, and we put all our energy towards that, and I'm kind of done with the acting thing. And I went in for one pilot season show.
Yeah.
It was the day that Vinyl got picked up. I was waiting for that news so I could tell them, like, so they wouldn't yell at me about saying I don't want to audition for a year, because I was like, you're still going to get paychecks for Vinyl.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I'm making some money for you.
Right.
Even, you know, not a lot, but whatever. So the day that news comes out, I get two things happen. One is I go in for an audition at CBS for a sitcom that I was like, well, that's the last one, because now Vinyl's been picked up and I'm not going to do the rest of this pilot season shit. I was recurring on Vinyl. I wasn't regular, but I was still like, I'd rather do this than do a crappy sitcom or whatever. I can't have my heart broken again was also kind of my thing.
Yeah.
Especially watching how the Mulaney thing got butchered with the notes and everything.
Yeah.
There was this whole thing of like, man, if Mulaney can't make it through this system, you know, and Lorne Michaels is producing it for him and they're still fucking up the whole show.
Network, man.
Right. Network.
Yeah.
But, I go in for that CBS audition, and I'm like, there we go. That's the last one.
Yeah.
I'm done this year now. It's February. The show's been picked up. I do that during the day. They call me in, like, once or twice a month to smoke a cigarette, and I do stand up on the road. Yeah. Like, that's my year. And I check my phone, and I get the audition self-tape for the tech.
Isn't that funny how that happens?
Yeah.
It's so crazy. So many, like, similar stories to that where it's like, I'm almost done.
I had the email drafted to send to them.
Did you save it?
I saved it, yeah. But I was like... Well, I can't not see if I could get cast on the Tick.
Right.
I need to, because, like, the Tick was, for me, what Ninja Turtles wasn't. That was
right,
a big thing.
Yeah.
And
your sense of humor.
All of it. Yeah. And, like, loved the Warburton show. My brother and I watched it together religiously, then went back to the cartoons. Like, loved it. Loved it. Knew it well.
Right.
I get the audition. I'm like, what part is it? It's Arthur. Holy shit.
Right.
Then I read the script. I'm like, this one's really about Arthur. Like, Arthur's the central character of this. So I simultaneously go, well, now there's no chance I get it. If he's really the star of the thing, they're going to want to get someone who's a proven entity. But I need to ride this out and see how far I can get with it. So I just, I get kind of obsessive about that part.
Yeah.
And do a self-tape, because they weren't seeing people in New York. But the casting director liked me. I'd never met her before, but she had wanted to put me in something else, and it didn't work out. And she sort of kept like, I gotta find a part for him someday. And what I find out after the fact is she gets this and goes, this is the Griffin part. Like, she, in her mind, was like, my job is to get him hired for this.
That's awesome.
But that's the way this stuff happens, is you, over time, find champions who help you.
Yeah.
I do my self-tape. They send it in to Edlund, Ben Edlund, who is creator of all things Tick and showrunner of this show as well. He likes it. He's going to be in New York, meet with people. Everyone else he's meeting with is like an established TV actor.
Sure.
But I go get coffee with him, and I think I just said all the right stuff.
Yeah.
You know, of just understanding the tapestry of this thing. I was trying to hide how much of a mega fan.
Because you knew it, but you didn't want to come up like super fanboy that way. It's like, oh, he just what's this going to be? If is this going to affect the performance itself?
Well, my thing too, when I was doing stand up, so much of my stand up routine was like Fozzie Bear. I think Fozzie Bear is like the funniest character in history.
He's pretty great.
And the dynamic of like of just him backstage going like, Kermit, I got a hot one.
Yeah.
This is gonna kill.
Yeah.
And everyone going like, Fozzie, are you sure? Maybe you shouldn't do this. He's like, trust me.
Right.
And then he goes out on stage, it bombs immediately. Right. Yeah. Immediately everything goes wrong.
Yeah.
Statler and Waldorf do not hesitate for a second to rip into him.
Right.
And the veneer comes down. He's like, guys, please, I'm trying my hardest.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I just, as a kid, used to think that was the funniest thing in the world. Whereas in doing stand-up, and for a long time, my friends would be like, you are overthinking this. Just tell jokes. I was like, the thing I'd love to do is say something on stage, the audience laughs at it, and then I react like they weren't supposed to laugh at that, and I'm embarrassed and they're judging me.
Right.
Right? And as the set goes on, I feel more and more like my confidence is crumbling.
Yeah.
Which was difficult and took a lot of energy. And when it didn't work, it really didn't work.
It's kind of like an Andy Kaufman-ish type thing?
A little bit. Yeah. Not that heightened.
Yeah.
But I was really interested in that energy.
Yeah.
And Ben, you know, doesn't talk about things in literal terms. He talks about things in bigger sort of metaphorical terms and everything. But he was sort of talking about the iconography and how he felt like this needed to evolve and what the Tick was saying about modern superhero culture. And I was like, I knew how to answer those questions to show that I understood what the reference points were for him. And then he just sort of said, like, Arthur's really difficult because here's this character that's always mostly been like a comedic device.
Sure.
Isn't it funny if a guy is terrified, right? If a superhero is terrified. But he was mostly a comic relief character.
Mm-hmm.
And my whole idea for this show is, can I make him an actual protagonist? Can I make him a character with real feelings and stakes and interiority? Because the Tick can't change.
Right.
The Tick is an immovable object, right? He can't question himself that much. He is so certain in what he does.
Right.
There's only so much of an arc you can give the Tick before he stops being the Tick.
Right.
So in coming up with this new version, I realized it has to be an Arthur sort of hero story that the Tick is obviously right there for every step of the way.
Right.
And what's difficult is I'm trying to deal with this heavy stuff. I'm doing this version of the show that deals with mental illness and a suicidal guy and all this sort of stuff. But he has to remain funny. And the balance for me is finding someone who can play the actual stakes of the thing but land all the jokes, because I worry about going too far in one direction or the other. And I said, look, here's what I've been working on in stand-up for the last 7 years.
Yeah.
Right? I just sort of said, here are all my findings and when I've tried this and when it hasn't worked and this and that. And I'm usually doing this thing. And sometimes my stand-up routine is this guy suicidal and this and that? And I played all this sort of stuff. And I just ran through, like, I've been doing R&D for 7 years, and here's all of what I found. And if you're talking about needing that specific thing, I might be the guy who knows how to do that well.
Right.
And also, I'm tiny.
Right, right.
And you need a little Arthur, right?
Right.
You need whoever you cast to make the guy playing Tick look even bigger. I go do that. My agents email me. They're like, you're Ben Edlund's first choice. I go, congratulations, amazing, Griffin, you nailed it, unbelievable. Right. And they go, hold on, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
They were like, we just need to be realistic here. Like, we know the conversations that are happening at Sony and at Amazon. They want a star. It's really unlikely.
Yeah.
You know, you're still in the mix, but they are, like, sending out straight offers to so many people. And if any of those people say yes, you're out. You know? And not even auditioning that many other people. Yeah. So, like, we're going to stay on it and fight aggressively for it, but it's an uphill battle.
Right.
And then the thing that happens is...
But is that good? That's got to be pretty good that they did it that way, right? Because it's like, because you're at least preparing yourself?
I think so, yeah. The next day, I get an email that the CBS sitcom I'd auditioned for, uh-huh. the one where I was like, this is the last one, wanted me to test.
So fucking crazy.
And I thought that was like the worst audition I'd ever done in my life.
So crazy how the universe just works, man. Yeah.
Right. I'm dating someone at the time, and I remember waking up, checking my phone, turning over to her and going, holy shit.
Yeah.
And she went, what? And I went, I'm going to get the Tick. And she went, what? And I said, I know exactly what's going to happen here because I went through this with the Mulaney thing and the other times I was testing and the Ninja Turtles thing. Yeah. The fact that CBS now wants me is going to light a fire under Amazon's ass, and they're going to think that there's something that CBS knows that they don't know, and suddenly I will seem like a commodity to them, and that is exactly what happened.
Wow.
And, like, I had Ben in my corner. I had the casting director in my corner, Barry Josephson, the producer, eventually, Wally Pfister. But, like, they brought me in for a screen test, and they were like, we know there's the CBS deal. There's a ticking clock. They want you to sign a test deal. And for people who don't know, when you're testing for shows, it's like if you're testing for a network TV show, I guess it's maybe a little less with cable at this point and streaming, especially in pilot season when everything's going at the same time, they want you to sign a contract locking in what your deal would be before you even do the final audition so that if they choose you, you have no leverage in negotiations.
Right.
So they're like, here's your 7-year contract, right? And if you sign this, we have a hold on you until we decide whether or not we want you, and you're off the table and no one else can even consider you. And so that was the fear of God they were able to put into Amazon, which my reps played very well of, like, CBS wants him to sign this thing, like, immediately.
Let's do it.
And he's going to do it unless you give him a test.
What was the show, can you say?
The Great Outdoors with Joel McHale.
Okay.
They ended up just casting McLovin.
Okay.
Chris Rance-Plasse, great actor. I don't say that derisively.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things where, like, I believe if I had tested for that, they would have gone, well, why don't we just see if McLovin's available and pay him 8 times more. I didn't want to do it. That was the other thing. I was very much in my headspace of, I'd be happy just doing stand-up.
Right.
I don't need to do this.
But you used it as a negotiation tool.
Absolutely. Right. I was never going to test for that thing. Right. But I used it as a negotiation tool. It got them to bring me into the room.
What was that?
And there were no executives there. It was Edlund. It was Felicia Fasano, the casting director, Wally Pfister. And Valerie Curry had already been cast.
Okay.
Played my sister on the show. Yeah. She was the first person cast. They hadn't found a Tick yet. So I was able to do the chemistry test with her. And they were like, everyone in this room wants you to get this part. The goal of today is just however much time it takes to get the best tape to send to the execs and go, come on.
Yeah.
And so that took a lot of pressure off of it.
Yeah.
And
everybody was on you. It was you all same team. There's no one not on your team in that room.
Right.
And it, right.
Right. And it worked. Easy. And it worked.
It was great. You know how we're connected to the Tick, right? Ish?
No, I don't think so.
So when I was becoming a regular at the Comedy Store and doing the stuff, I lived with my buddy Adam Winkleman.
Okay.
And so Adam had a girlfriend that a lot of us were very creative, and we would do these sketches, and I would bounce stuff off of her, and she would bounce off of me, and she was a struggling actress and making her way up. Ziana Martinez. So
the best.
She's the best.
The best.
And she's such a sweetheart. I love her to death.
The best.
She's the best. So that was how, because when after you and Peter came in,
she
came in not too long after.
Right.
So where they you guys were promoting the show and your publicist has reached out. Afterwards, I just reached out to Yana.
Yeah.
I was like, come on the show. She's like, hell yeah. So she's the best.
She's one of my favorite.
She's such a
people
down to earth, just real person. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that show was very difficult to make. And I was very frustrated, obviously, by how it ended.
Yeah.
But it was just everyone on that show was so wonderful. Like, I liked so much as people and really enjoyed
playing with.
I mean, It was very hard. It's one of those things where, like, growing up, I would watch movies like Ghostbusters or Men in Black or Galaxy Quest and go, why isn't everything like this? Like, why isn't everything a comedy that has special effects and action set pieces and everything?
Right.
And then you try doing that and you're like, oh, because it's impossible. It is so tough to reconcile those different elements. The process of getting funny performances on set runs so counter to the technical precision and the mathematical pre-planning of visual effects. And even just everyone wearing these prohibitive costumes and contact lenses and everything.
Yes.
It's very hard to do.
It is. And I know that, I remember you telling me that, I think when we started talking about Schmodown, and just on a conversation, how, because you have so many different things that you're paying attention to, like you were talking about with it being taught in school.
Yes.
They definitely don't teach you that.
No. Yeah. I mean, the amount of things, the amount of problem solving that had to be done in any given scene of that show was intense.
Yeah.
It was a good burn, and it was a thing I would have happily done for as many years as they let me.
I'm sure.
But it was like it was a lot of work. Yeah.
I'm sure. Well, we are here with Griffin Newman, and yes, I'm definitely gonna he and I not talk about Masters of the Universe?
Well,
of course,
I tried to tee it up to that point.
We are going to, and before what we do, and before we end with Masters, I also wanted to let you guys know already, and we were talking earlier. Before, and we were talking about draft day.
Mm.
Well, let me tell you about DraftKings, ladies and gentlemen. DraftKings, if you didn't know already, we've been back with DraftKings. We were DraftKings man back in the Schmoes No days, and we're back with them now. And it's great to have the teams back on the gridiron. Football season is upon us, and lucky for us, that was just the first week, ladies and gentlemen. DraftKings, it is the official daily fantasy partner of the NFL. They put you in the center of the action now for week number two. New customers, if you sign up, you get a free shot at millions of dollars in total prizes with your first deposit. And you just got to sign up, and you have to use that code SENLIVE. Don't just sign up. Use a code SENLIVE. You get in on the action now. It's simple. You pick your lineup. You stay under the salary cap, and you see how your team stacks up against the competition. You feel the NFL action like never before with a free shot at millions of dollars in total prizes. The way that you do this, do it on your phone right now. Download the DraftKings app and use the code SENLIVE because this week, new customers get a free shot at millions of dollars in total prizes, but you have to use that code SENLIVE to get a free shot at millions in those prizes with your first deposit. That's code SENLIVE only at DraftKings, the official daily fantasy partner of the NFL. It's a minimum of $5 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. You know, getting into Masters of the Universe. Mm-hmm. So I know it was funny because when you came into Schmodown, you had mentioned to me, you're like, well, I know you're a big Masters guy. Did you see that thing that they did, the big documentary? Is that where you realized it? Because I didn't even realize there was some big documentary on YouTube where my story of how I was involved with Masters was in there.
I've watched all those documentaries, but I think I don't know how.
Yeah.
Maybe it was because we were about to do Collider Live, or maybe it was because we had just done it.
Yeah.
But I saw the video where you on Collider Live were running through your history of trying to develop it at Silver. So I knew it because of that before I watched the documentary.
Okay.
But I remember, because I'm a huge Motu fan.
You are, yeah.
So you notice when someone else is, because it's not something that everyone likes Batman.
Right. And because I think there's such a misconception with the property where people, because it was developed because of the toys and everything too, and they wanted, and it was basically Conan the Barbarian is what they wanted to do. And then when it was developed and it came out in the 80s, the majority of people fell in love with it because of the 80s.
Yep.
There's a lot of great lore inside of that 80s.
Yes.
It's
yes.
great lore.
Yes.
But a lot of it's pretty cheesy, you know, and a lot of it, the drawings, the animation, like tons of stuff. So when the 2002 version came out, that to me was like, someone figured it out, and it didn't do very well. It did okay.
That was like my generation. I had an older friend at summer camp who got me into the Filmation Classic stuff, but it was very hard to watch or find anything.
Yeah.
But I was like being sold on that the year or two before the 2000X series comes out. And then that I was all in on. I had all the figures. I was watching the show every week. Yeah. I was like, that was my... the one I got to live through, you know?
And well, the lore in that one, they really expanded on it.
Great.
I like the idea of the thousands of years before He-Man, like the how more of the origin on Skeletor, all of it. And So my frustration with Masters of the Universe, besides the shit that I went through, mm-hmm. but like the idea that nobody really could grasp what this thing was live action, right?
Yeah, which it's so bizarre because it seems so obvious to me.
It's Star Wars meets Lord of the Rings. Right. It's fantasy and right. magic, science and magic. It's all of that and. Yeah. Lord of the Rings, and then you see a spaceship kind of fly through it. It's really all it is.
And even if you just look at any image from the Filmation show, and you just go, just imagine this in live action now, it feels like the most epic thing in the world. Even though it's banal images, we're just, even just down to like the purple skies of everything. The depth of the vehicles, the buildings, the characters, all this stuff. And yeah, there's like, you had a lot of very high-level people like Paul Dini and J. Michael Straczynski who were writing on that show and were like trying to put as much into a show that could have just been a tossed-off toy commercial, right? But then the fact that it is designed to be a toy commercial give this show this weird power because they just had to keep on putting more and more into it. Expanded so quickly because they just had to keep on working in all the products. So the world just felt like infinite.
Yeah.
I hope people understand because obviously you can't really talk about Motu these days in a post-revelation world without people having being very defensive about it.
Yes.
But I hope people know what the origin of this term is. But like the upstate New York garbage plate, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like a dish where it's like, what if you just put everything good in one thing?
Right.
That's what I view Motu as. It's like a garbage plate where it was, you have a bunch of executives who at Mattel who want to fight Star Wars.
Yeah.
And they go, how do we beat Star Wars? And the pitch was, is it a barbarian thing? Is it a military thing? Is it a sci-fi tech thing? And they went, it's all of it.
Just put it in there.
Just put everything in there. And the fact, I've always loved the sort of messiness of the mythology in that, like, the mini comics bump up against the Filmation show, 2000X, you know, new adventures, the toys have their own inner mythology.
Yeah.
But that if you pick and choose from it, there are so many interesting things you can do there.
Yeah.
And there's so many things, like, for me, I mean, not to jump ahead, but, like, Revelation for me is, like, taking this Teela plot line that's been there the whole time but has never really
the
been
the second or third episode in the in
Teela's
the,
quest is in the first 10
and I it's like it's one of the, it might be the second or third
it's very early.
Yeah.
And it's that's been there the entire time you know, but that was a show that couldn't really be serialized and had to keep on pushing and this and that, and it's like there's so many little pockets you can go into there and find really interesting things.
Well, this is what you were gonna say.
No, I was gonna say, as opposed to the Tick, where it was just like needing to line everything up perfectly, but also this audition email just lands in my lap. Motu was a thing where I just like actively pursued it.
Did you know Kevin beforehand?
I had met him. I don't even know if he remembers this, but I had like doing Comic-Con stuff for the Tick.
Yeah,
I had done stuff that he moderated, interviewed a couple times.
Okay.
But that's like a very transactional thing. I didn't know him personally at all. Two of the writers who were hired onto the show, I did know. One of whom through mutual friends. One of whom because she was the writer's assistant on season one of The Tick.
Got it.
The one friend, Eric Carrasco, who worked on Supergirl with my friend Derek Simon, who's like my oldest childhood friend.
Right.
And then Eric's written for a bunch of different DC stuff, the animated movies, Justice League action, tons of stuff. But he wrote most of the episodes that Kevin directed on Supergirl.
Yeah.
So Kevin brought him in, and he's, like, really deep on DC.
Okay.
He likes Motu. He knows he doesn't know it as well as he could because he knows what it's like to be a mega fan.
Sure.
So he's, like, 2-3 days before the writer's room is opening, he goes to Derek, and he's like, do you know anyone who, like, knows Motu well? And he's like, Griffin. Call Griffin. And I have, like, an hour-long phone call with him where he was just like, I just want to hear from someone who's, like, a mega fan. What are the things that you like most about this? What are the things you'd most want to see in a show? Yeah. What are the things, this and that? And I was sort of explaining to him, like, it is a messy mythology. Everything negates itself, you know? I think what's cool, like, fundamentally is that it's magic and tech.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anyone's ever really reckoned with that, the weird contrasting energy of the I'm not presenting any of this as if I was pitching ideas, but I was just saying, like, these are things I've always liked.
Yeah.
And it's the depth of the characters and the diversity of all these weird elements and it, just everything being mashed in there and all this sort of stuff. And then at the end of it, he went, and what do you think about Orko? And I went, well, Orko's like the divisive character.
Yeah.
Like, you know, depending, I think, on what age you were, and it could really be off by a year or two, it feels like for people who grew up with it, Orko is either C-3PO or Jar Jar.
Right.
Right? It's either like, well, he's essential, or like that's the one thing that ruined the seriousness of the thing for
that's
me.
That's true. A lot of people, I'm on the C-3PO side of it, but...
Me too.
But you're 100% right.
Right, and I think some people like to now act like everyone always liked Orko.
Right.
Which, like, I was on those message boards 20 years ago.
It's not the case.
It's not the case. Right. It's not the case. Even if it was more people who liked him, it is like, if you were watching the show when you were 8 as opposed to 6,
right,
you might go like, Orko's a little silly for my taste, you know? Yeah. But I was saying, like, I think he's fundamental and essential in this and that. And I was even sort of relating it to, like, it's the Fozzie Bear thing for me. It's the fact that he tries so hard every time he thinks this trick's going to work and it doesn't.
Right.
But he perseveres in the face of that, realizing the moment, like, oh, there are these weird overlaps with Arthur. And he's this tiny, underqualified, flying dude who's trying to do the thing. And he went, because, like, am I crazy or I feel like you'd be good as Orko? And I was like, well, yes, obviously I would be good as Orko, yes. And he was like, okay, I mean, I don't know if I have any power, but certainly I independently had that thought.
Yeah.
That you seem like you could play Orko well.
Right.
Who knows if that goes anywhere. Yeah. And my other friend gets hired there. So the one, like, advantage I had was I knew before the show had been announced.
Yeah.
So I gave my agents the heads up. Like, this is...
It's coming.
It's coming.
Yeah.
Let's get in there early.
Right.
And they were like, why this part?
Right.
You know, I'm like coming off of the Tick and they were like, you should be like a leading man on television. I'm like, I really want to play Orko.
Yeah.
Like that's the priority for me.
Yeah.
And I really just kind of put like everything into it because I felt it was a character that would be very easy to get wrong.
Yeah.
And I also felt, to a certain degree, I felt a little bit of this with Arthur. I felt a lot more of it with Orko, where it's like, it would be great to win over everyone who used to think this character was annoying.
Right.
It would be great to find a way to add a little depth to it, not in any way criticizing the people who played it before, but just the shows were different. Yeah. What was asked from them is different. Right. This is going to be a more modern show. It's a little more adult-oriented.
Yeah.
Can you add a little more depth... and sort of emotional texture to this character, so it becomes impossible to write off, while not transforming him radically enough that he's no longer recognizable as the thing you grew up with.
Right.
Which was the thing I had to do with Arthur, where it's like, now this guy is a lot more intense and has a lot more interiority and you know, is a lot more realistic than just being like, Tick, I don't know, you know?
Right, right, right.
But I want anyone who loves him to hear him and go, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
He's not doing a take on it that has the right pitch.
Yeah.
What I always said to Ben was, like, we're taking the house that you already built and we're putting an attic and a basement on it.
Right.
You know? We're just expanding the range of what can be done there.
Yeah.
So I really was, like, you know, I would like to play Orko for selfish reasons, but I also think I know how to do it.
Well, certainly. I mean, obviously, I thought you did a great job. I told you that. I think my daughter, who watched the series, absolutely loved Orko. And there are spoilers, by the way, so people who have not watched it, you should know that. There is... Look, we've talked about this. There was a massive explosion online for there are people who loved it. There were a lot of people who just didn't. And there is. So my thing when I talked to you because you wanted to know my thoughts on the show.
And honestly, and like by the way, I when there is such a sort of like organized online a backlash.
Yeah,
and I say organized because there were YouTube channels that for 9+ months in advance of the thing ever premiering, we're doing sort of like panicky, like,
what's this going to be? Uh-oh.
Beyond that, like, we hear it's woke SJW agenda, you know, like, and, you know, half the things that they're leaking are correct, but they're presenting it in the wrong context.
That's my thing.
In the process, they're spoiling the show. And then the other half of the stuff they're saying is incorrect extrapolation, fear-based on what they think from what they know is going on there. And there's a lot of, like, misreading into it.
Yeah.
I am very willing to accept valid criticism, and I also think that Motu in particular, all the iterations of it have been different enough, and they don't fit well with each other enough that people have their preference, and... You're never going to be able to please everybody. As much as this show was trying to pull a little something from everything, you know, I mean, the story I've told is that, like, when the trailer got posted on AV Club, and I was checking the comments, the first comment was someone saying, like, hard pass for me. In my opinion, He-Man ended when it stopped being a cave guy who leaves his small tribe and gets a harness from the Green Goddess. And it's like, that's mini comic number one. Right. Packaged with the first year of toys before there's a cartoon show, before they're long form comics.
How old was
comics.
This guy, like 65?
Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? But the point is, for that guy, it was done.
Right.
It peaked in the very first stage. Right? And I'm like, that's a valid opinion.
Right.
There are people who like that canon of it more.
Right.
And they like this canon more and that canon more. And so, like, if especially if you're trying to combine a little bit of everything, it's not going to please everybody.
Right.
I was very curious for your opinion because I knew you'd be honest with me. Yeah. And you were a fan. And if it felt like it didn't hit the right boxes or went against fundamental tenets for you, that you would be honest.
100%.
Yeah.
And I said it to you in the same thing that I said. I believe I said it on the air, and I'll say it again, too. The animation is gorgeous.
It's incredible. The powerhouse. It's amazing work.
100%. Yeah. The tone itself hits it. My biggest criticism with it is not the angle itself. I think the angle of the story itself works. And I know some people are like, wait, it works? You don't think He-Man should be? You can replace and you can remove things, and He-Man's coming back. If you don't think he's coming back, you're out of your fucking mind. But like the point,
you've either never watched anything or you're being willfully obtuse.
But what I do agree with is I don't think you should have started with that. I think that you should have started and gotten people reattached to this world, because it wasn't like it just went off the air. It's been off the air for a long time. Yeah. So if people were then, okay, look, this is the world again. Look at what we're doing here. Yeah. This is He-Man. This is Adam. This is what he does. And for like 7-8 episodes, you're on adventures with He-Man. You're seeing what he does. You're seeing him kick ass, battle against Skeletor.
Yeah.
And then this angle happens. I think, first of all, I think it not only diffuses, but it also gives those people less of an argument to say, that's a SJW thing right off the top.
Yes.
Because...
Yeah.
It's like it leads into it. It's part of the arc. It seems like, and I know it's not, but it seems like this is what the show is. Deal with it, fuckers. It's not that. It's different. And if you have a problem with her haircut, you have a problem with her haircut, for God's sakes. Who cares?
Right. And by the way, you know, there's this weird sort of circuitous thing of people saying, like, why do they need to make everything so political, even down to the haircut? And it's like, you are the one now politicizing the haircut.
It's a haircut.
The haircut's a haircut. Do you want to know why she has that haircut? Because that's the haircut that Kyler Lee has on Supergirl, and Kevin directed an episode with her before he started work on this, and he was like, that's a cool haircut.
And which means the haircut did not bother me at all.
Right.
The only thing that I said was like, I like this angle. I see the Lord of the Rings thing they're doing with Orko. Yeah. I see all this. I just said, it would have been so much more impactful if I had more Orko in my life for 7 or 8 episodes. And then he dies-ish in that 7th or 8th episode, or 9th episode, rather. And then I'm like, oh, shit. Well, they're going to bring him back, obviously. But, man, I was so attached to him. Because I was attached to him in this because I knew him so well.
Sure.
But for new people coming in, it's like, he's in, he's out, he's gone. And it does seem, does show like, well, He-Man's dead. Orko's dead. We're going to kill all the dudes. And I know that's not what Kevin's going for. I know that it's not. But I also understand how people look at it and they go, oh, that's what they're doing? And it's like, no, they're not doing that.
Right.
You just have to. I just thought it should have led up to a little bit more.
I'll say two things about this that I think I can pull back the curtain to this degree.
Yeah.
One of which was there were 10 episodes written all at once.
Right.
It was designed very much as a 10-episode miniseries.
Yeah.
And the thought was always that they were all going to be released at the same time.
Right.
And I believe the fundamental thing that messed that up was COVID.
Yeah.
Because sort of the first half of the season was recorded, they were animating, and then the second half of the season was going to get recorded in terms of the voice work 3 months later.
Yeah.
And it ended up being 9 months later.
Right.
Because they didn't want people back in studio.
Right.
So that the first 5 episodes got done a lot faster, and the... second 5 were at a little bit of a delay.
Yeah.
They wanted to hit whatever that release date was. I think it was maybe tied to the hope that Comic-Con and everything would still happen at that point, and that July would be a good launching pad for that and whatever. There was sort of a game time decision of the first 5 are 100% locked. The second 5 are like 90% locked.
Right.
Do you want to wait another 4 months to release all 10, or do we want to get 5 out here right now?
Right.
The other thing is there's the second Netflix kids show, He-Man, which I'll get to in a second because that ties into your thing. And they wanted to launch it before that, so there could be a classic before the re-thing. And there are a lot of things that are above my pay grade,
I
still perhaps am simplifying in how I explain it.
Right.
But I think the story makes a lot more sense if you watch 10. And I do think that You know, I've gotten to read all the scripts. I haven't gotten to watch all of them.
You know what's going to happen, though, right?
I do, and like the episodes I'm not in, I wanted to read.
I don't mean inside the story itself. I mean, like, you know, once what's going to happen is because you already know how it's going to go.
Yes, I know exactly what's going
to happen. It's going to be released, and all these things are going to happen that were supposed to happen anyway.
And they're going to say we did it. It was Sonic the Hedgehog. We got him changed the design. Yep. Absolutely.
Yep.
I mean, it was like the moment the first five episodes came out. They had 1 week of work left on the remaining five.
Yeah.
There was nothing changed by any fan response.
I know, but that's not
they're going to take credit. They're going to take credit.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people who are never going to accept it.
Yeah.
And there are people who are going to say, well, now it's good because they did this.
Right.
And come back around to it. Right. And there are people who will just watch all 10 for the first time now, and I think it will go down smoother.
Yeah.
But that, I think, did screw us up in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
The same thing happened with The Tick. There were similar machinations where our first season was 6 and 6 that were split up because they wanted to launch at Comic-Con, and we only started filming late.
Right.
And it was like we filmed 12 episodes, and then a week later we were promoting the first 6. It was like a blur.
Yeah.
And then, and this is another problem in the streaming age, is people watch 6 episodes or 5 episodes. I don't mean to criticize anyone, but I think in the case of both The Tick and in Motu Revelation, I do not think either streaming service did a good job of communicating this is just half of a season.
Right.
I kind of think
terrible job, to be honest with you.
Horrible. I'll say that.
I didn't even know when the second half was coming out.
They still have not announced it.
Yeah.
And I kind of believe that if you're going to do that, as someone who is now both times, and The Tick backlash was not the same thing,
right.
But I saw people going like, well, now how long do I have to wait? Is the show canceled? This and that. And you want to yell at people like, we're done. They're done. They're sitting in a hard drive somewhere. They're the done.
Yeah.
It's not our choice. We didn't want you to watch it this way.
Right.
But it was bizarre to me how little that was communicated.
Yeah.
Where anytime I was doing anything to promote the show, and I was, they're not sending me out to do press. The stuff I've been doing is stuff like this, where it's like friends, oh, do you want to come on? Can I come on your thing? Whatever. I love talking about He-Man.
Yeah.
I was saying this stuff as loudly as I could from my limited platform because I felt like no one else was communicating that.
Right.
I think if you're going to do that, you have to sort of say, here's part one. We're advertising it as part one. The title is part one. We're telling you before part one comes out when part two is coming out.
100%. Just wait and sit back before you.
I think that's how you have to frame it because in both Tick and He-Man, I've seen people go, well, what now? What if the show gets canceled? Because we're all used to streaming services putting a lot of money and time into something and then abandoning it and the story is unresolved.
Right.
And that's really frustrating to people. And so if they're watching 5 episodes, that they think is a complete statement, right? That in their mind, they think that was all they intended to do, and they were happy ending the show at that point.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to get angry about it when it's like, those are 5 episodes that work up to the end of Empire.
I agree.
Up to a low.
Yeah, I just, it like
everything's
said,
broken, and now the drama is, how does everything get put back together? Because no spoilers, but like, of course, the point of the show is to reassemble the status quo.
Yes.
Having changed, you know, people having learned and evolved over the course of this, but like, he didn't want to just break the entire universe.
Right. I don't think that was. Look, I've been pretty critical on. I mean, when I first saw Last Jedi, when I saw it in the theater, I didn't really know. I didn't know how to. People were like, "Why didn't you tweet?" I'm like, "I don't. I'm processing."
Yeah.
And then when I saw it the second time, I said, "You know what? This is a really good movie, and I stand by the fact it's a very well made film."
Yeah.
It's one of my least favorite Star Wars movies now.
Sure.
The more and more I watch it.
Sure.
But I do think that Rian Johnson intended to shift things and to move things around a bit, right? I don't think that was Kevin's intent at all.
No, it was not. It was fundamentally not.
Yes.
And I think the thing that is a little confounding to me is there are such deep cuts on that show, both in writing, in animation, in story plot points, in callbacks to things, you know, and not just like Easter egg stuff, but really wanting to pull from every corner of the thing, that whether or not you like what they did, to like throw out the accusation of insincerity of they don't even like or know this thing at all.
That's not fair.
It's like clearly they do. You can dislike what they did with it. And I know it's shitty for me to say, well, you can't judge yet because you haven't seen the whole thing. Of course you can judge. You can have your feelings about the first 5.
Right.
But that was not how anyone intended for it to be seen.
Right.
The second thing I was going to say is that in terms of you talking about wishing there was more of a status quo before the dramatic thing happens, my understanding, and I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this, is that, you know, Mattel really wanted to bring Motu back. It's been dormant for a while. Yeah. The last couple of years, they start doing comics. They start developing new toy lines. They know they need to do a series. This movie has been in the works forever. A couple years ago, it seemed like it was closer to happening, and they thought it would maybe be coming out around now.
Right.
And they wanted a new series to go along with that, right? And their priority was doing what is now the show that's about to premiere, He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, which is CGI, kid-oriented. Yeah. It's a little more Ben 10 techie sort of stuff. It's a much more radical reinvention of everything, right, from square one. And that the idea of doing Revelation was more of like a pet project from some very committed people that they had to work really hard to sell on. Can we please do this?
Yeah.
There are hardcore fans who are older, who have loved this thing at different points in time. If we're going to do this hard reboot, and I don't know where the movie stands right now, but the movie as it was planned a couple of years ago also would have been a pretty divergent take from what has been known before.
Yeah, I've seen scripts.
Didn't like it.
No.
Didn't like it, right? You know, hopefully now if we get a live action movie, it is more faithful. But I think they knew, oh, we're going to have two big radical reinventions, and a lot of the big Motu fans were like, you know, and Teddy Biaselli, who's the executive at Netflix, who has like a house, a room in his house devoted
to Kevin's talked about it. Yeah.
Motu.
Yeah,
he's and he comes from animation. He was a stop motion guy. Yeah. He's like one of the few execs I've ever met, if not the only exec I've ever met, who like, you're like, you are creative. You actually are, you know. It's his favorite thing. And there was just this passion of like, could we do this? Can we just do 10 episodes that are for the people who grew up with this thing? So the idea of being able to establish more of a status quo to then disrupt it was like the entire existence of the show is almost a cookie.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I think then as it started developing, then Mattel got really bullish on it. The fact that there are now figures and merchandise and they put more of a push behind it was only when they were really getting amped by what they were seeing as it came along. And now, you know, the intention is to do another season.
So to them, it's like, make it count. So they're like, so Kevin and
exactly.
Like, I get it. So it's like, you know, well, all right, I could do this, but really this is the meat of my story.
They sort of treated it as this is the epilogue to everything that came before.
Right.
And that all is the lead up
Lead up, right.
Which, that is the...
I get it. I just think I think that it proves to be a little
absolutely.
Tough.
Yeah, absolutely. But a lot of it comes down to just how many working parts there are in these things, you know?
Well, look, man, it was an absolute pleasure to have you on here today.
So much fun.
When are you coming back in L.A.? You going to be in – I know – I mean, look, I'm going to see you in New York.
Yes.
I'm going to see October 9th, by the way, if you didn't know. Griffin Newman plays Josh Horowitz in the undercard of the – and now – oh, no, I can't say yet. I can't say it what the main event is. I almost spoiled the main event.
Okay.
I can't spoil the main event yet, but it's for the singles championship. I can tell you, you will find out, everybody, tonight on pay-per-view between Marisol McKee and Ethan Irwin. The winner of that will play Chance Ellison in the main event. Griffin will be there, and then so when are you gonna be back in LA?
Well, you asked this question, I throw it back to you to a certain degree, because at the time we're recording this tomorrow, King Arthur, the first teams match of myself and Jeffrey King Kong happens. If that goes well, we're on to the next level. If I beat Horowitz, I'm on to the next level.
Then you could potentially be out here for
a lot of incentivization to get back here soon if I have two more matches.
I love that. I love that. And that's very possible because you're playing up a storm right now. Ladies and gentlemen, Griffin Newman, please follow him at Griff Lightning. Make sure you check out, if you haven't gone and watched The Tick, go back and watch The Tick.
Please do.
Go back and watch The Tick. Please do. And then obviously watch Motu. So much more Griffin Newman's coming. Check out Blank Check as well, everybody. Check out Blank Check. Awesome having you, my man.
Thank you.
And we will see you guys next time. Make sure you subscribe to us, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Leave some comments. I've been responding to everybody here. Peace out, Mother Effs.